being my top five verses. But as I'm thinking through top fives, top threes, top things, last week we talked about or had you match up like some of the things that our staff and connected, which is their favorite. Today I wanted to simplify it a little bit and give you the top five poisonous animals in the world and have you rank them from most poisonous to least poisonous, realizing that these five are the top five, so all of them can be pretty severe. So I want to show you each one, and then once I have them all on there, then you can rate them. So in no particular order, here is the first one, which is by name, the Death Stalker Scorpion. I don't know if you've ever come across one of these before. If you have, you were probably in either Africa, specifically South Sudan, in the village of Kalalai, which I visited. I didn't see one. I didn't know that they had them there, but apparently they do. But the Death Stalker Scorpion is a pretty vicious little critter. When you get stung by this, within minutes you go into a coma. And again, you can find these in Africa and the Middle East. Next one, which you will not find in South Sudan, is the blue-ringed octopus. Anyone ever heard of this one before? The blue-ringed octopus. Kind of a cool-looking little critter. Apparently, a drop of its blood can kill 26 people. One drop of, not its blood, its venom. One drop of its venom. I don't know about its blood. You can find this one in off of the shores of Australia and Japan. So that's a fun little critter. This next one, my first source, I had to double check because I didn't believe it. And I started to do more research on this guy, and I found out, yep, he is in the top five no matter what. And it is the marbled cone snail. I thought, how possibly could this one be? One drop of venom from the marbled cone snail can kill 20 people. This looks like, I mean, I think as a kid, I could have picked this one up at some point on the beach. The thing about it, one of the reasons why it's in the most deadly or most poisonous category is there is no antivenom for this one. They've not been able to develop one. So if you truly get the poison from this little snail, you're toast. You're done. There is no survival. The next one is probably one that you would say, oh yeah, that I know about. I know about this one. The king cobra. Now, the king cobra, a bite from a king cobra can kill a male elephant, which kind of will give you an idea of where you can find this one. You can find this one all throughout South Asia. But the poison from a king cobra is five times more powerful than any of the other cobras. So it is the king. Thank you. King cobra. You guys, I just want you to know, I know I've told you this before, you are so much smarter than first service. It's just... I don't know if it's because you've just been up longer or whatever it is, but I just like you guys better. Don't tell them that. I just do. The fifth one is the box jellyfish. Now, you're probably scared of jellyfish in one way or another and the stings that they can do. This one, again, Australia and throughout Asia is where you can find this box jellyfish. Its nickname is the sea wasp. And sting from this will kill you within minutes. So pretty powerful little guy. All right, so there's your five. Death Stalker Scorpion, blue-ringed octopus, marbled cone snail, king cobra, box jellyfish. Number one most poisonous on the list is, who thinks it's Death Stalker Scorpion? Let me see. Seriously, not one of you. Okay, how about the blue-ringed octopus? Okay, a few of you kind of like that one. Marbled cone snail? Most of you like that one. King cobra? Few. Box jellyfish? Okay. Well, some of you are right. Number one most poisonous on this list is the box jelly. Did you get that one right, Rick? Have you come across one? Yeah, it's the most poisonous. And then the next poisonous, these are actually in reverse order. So from bottom to top. King cobra would be next, followed by the marbled cone snail, blue-ringed octopus, and the sissy Death Stalker Scorpion. Pulling up in last place. They actually make, I have one of these for next time we head to South Sudan, but they make a light. It's like a UV light. It's like a flashlight, and you shine it, and apparently scorpions, something vescent, they, that's, what is it? I'm going to bring Sam with me, because he can only, but apparently they light up when you shine this light on them. So I will go nowhere without my light because of the Death Star or Scorpion. Though it is a sissy in the group, it's still pretty powerful little guy. So again, top verses. What are some of yours? What are some of your top verses? Like you say, this is my life verse or a verse that's been really meaningful to me. Can you tell me what it is? If you can quote it, that's great. If you can throw a few words out, maybe you just say it's somewhere in Romans. But what's some of your verses? Okay, give us a hint. Ooh, that's a good one. You guys like that one? All right, others? I saw another hand over here somewhere. John 3:16. That's right. You see that one at football games. Yeah, you do. Yeah. Very good. Yeah. Others of yours? Favorite verses? Yeah. That's right. God's for us. Who can be against us? Great one. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like when you look at, hear people tell you like what their, verses are that are very meaningful to them. It is as diverse as the scriptures are. Everybody has a different verse that's meaningful to them. The reason why is because, certain verses speak to a place of pain or speaks to a place of hurt or speaks to a place where there is something missing that the verse seems to complete or speak to or bring a wholeness to. And for me, as I do this series, I've kind of laughed about it because I say, this series is all about me. It's my four top verses. But it actually is a bit exposing, I've discovered. Because, I mean, this sounds, when I said this out loud in first service, I thought that sounded really weird, but I'll just repeat it again. Like, these four verses are only mine. Like, they're for me. They're from God to me. And to share them in this way feels a little, I don't know, like you're exposing yourself in some way because I'm revealing these things that are so deeply connected to my own faith, my own spiritual development, my development as a Christian man. And though the scriptures are for everybody, and just because they're my favorite doesn't mean they can't be yours, but it just feels so personal to me the way these verses have impacted me, spoke to me, ministered to me, and helped me through my life. And so as we share these, someone shares what their top verse is, listen to that, because there's something in that that they're saying as to how this has completed them in some way or strengthened them in some way or fulfilled them in some way or answered some of the deeper questions that we have about life. The verse I'm going to share for you today, last week we did 1 John 1:9, talked about this good news idea, which is something I desperately need to be reminded of at all times. But the verse I'm going to share today, I guarantee you that this verse is not on anybody's top 5, top 10, top 50, not even on their top 100. I bet this verse is not on anyone's top 1,000 verse list. And so it is odd that it's on my top 5 list. But what I want to do today is I want to hopefully move this verse, because this isn't going to be on any of your top lists either, but maybe I can get it into your top 500, but let me give you the verse, and then, you can make your determination, okay? It comes out of Exodus, chapter 14, verse 13, but I'm going to read verse 13 and verse 14. It says, "But Moses told the people, 'Don't be afraid, just stand still and watch the Lord rescue you today. The Egyptians you see today will never be seen again. The Lord himself will fight for you. Just stay calm.'" Can you see why that's my top five? Some of you are like, you are not making a good case here. No, I mean, of all the verses in the Bible to choose from, right? For a top five, why this one? Well, let me give you a little bit of background here. Okay, so prior to this verse and what's taking place here, we have Israel that has been enslaved in Egypt. And they've been enslaved for 400 years. That means they cannot remember back to a generation that has not been in slavery there. Obviously, their parents were slaves, their grandparents were slaves, their great-grandparents were slaves, the great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great- brutal. They were beaten. In fact, in their beatings, they were killed in their beatings. They were under tremendously difficult conditions in this hot sun, building bricks made with straw, having to gather their own straw in order to make the bricks. The work conditions were terrible. The food conditions, their living conditions. True slavery is as bad as it can possibly get, where these are just seen as commodities that could easily be discarded like trash. And this is how they lived generation after generation. Hundreds of thousands of Israelite people enslaved in Egypt. They'd been taken from the promised land, the place where God had given them. Their great ancestor Abraham was given this land. They left that land, came to Egypt, and there they became slaves and for hundreds of years, for centuries, slavery. And God heard the cries of the people, crying out over their slavery, crying out over their mistreatment. And so God sent a redeemer to the people. His name was Moses. That's right. Moses was going to be the redeemer. And so God worked these mighty miracles through Moses. We had these plagues, these 10 different plagues. Remember they're all kinds, like the gnats and the frogs and the river turning to blood. It was crazy things. And the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, he had this hard heart towards God and these people. Obviously, he didn't want to lose all this free labor that he had that was building all kinds of things and doing all this work for them. But Moses would come to him and say, "Let my people go. We need to go. We need to be able to leave here." Well, who's going to let that happen? But Pharaoh would say no, and then God would perform these miracle plagues, these terrible things that would happen there in Egypt. And of course, it would happen, devastate the people. People were afraid of it, God's mighty power. And so the Pharaoh would say what to Moses? He'd say, "Yeah, go, get." Like, "We don't want any more of this, go." And then they'd start to gather to go, and then Pharaoh would change his mind and say, "No, you're not leaving. Thought about it, forget it, you're not leaving. So you're going to stay." So then another plague. "Okay, you can go. Can't go. You're going to stay." This happened again and again and again until finally the 10th plague is the death of the firstborn male children in each household in Egypt. And so that night, all of these firstborn males die. And Pharaoh finally says, "That's it. Go. Just get out of here." They pack up. Now, what do they pack up? Next to nothing. Like, Moses says, "It's go time right now." So much so that from that point forward, when they celebrate this great moment of the Exodus, still to this day, as the Jewish people celebrate that Exodus moment, they eat bread that is unleavened, meaning it has no yeast in it. It never rose. And it's because they remember that they had to leave Egypt so fast, there was no time to put yeast in their dough and let it rise to bake it for bread. They had to do it with no yeast and just cook this crackery stuff. Here at Hillcrest, when we do communion, we do an unleavened bread. So maybe when it comes around, we pass it out. You're like, "I don't understand. Like, do we not tithe enough? How come Hillcrest cannot get bread that tastes like it's unleavened?" The whole idea is remembering how quickly they had to go. They had nothing. They had their slave clothes and their slave possessions, which was nothing, and they headed out to go to the land of milk and honey, this place that God had given them. And Moses was their leader, and he was leading them on. The people were cheering, and yes, we've done this thing. They get out, and they start moving into the desert to head to the promised land, and Pharaoh decides, "Nope, I want them back." So what Pharaoh does is he gathers the whole Egyptian army, highly trained warriors. They had armor. They had weapons, they had chariots, they had horses. And he gathers them all together, this massive army, and they head out after the Israelites. Now remember, the Israelites are literally on foot, just like running. And the whole army is coming after them. They are doomed. There's no way they're going to win this battle. And Moses is leading them, and Moses leads them into this area. And they start to go into this area, and there's mountains on either side, which... it's kind of a valley, and so you can't escape through the mountains. You have to keep going forward, and they keep going forward, 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 and all of a sudden they have to stop because what's in front of them? Water. this entire sea in front of them. And turn around, and who's coming down the valley after them? Pharaoh and the Egyptian army. They have the water in front, they have Pharaoh behind, they've got walls on either side, and it's a bad deal. It's about as bad as it can get. There's no hope for Israel in this moment. In fact, Pharaoh ends up hearing about their situation. And he says in Exodus 14:3, he says, the Israelites are confused. They are trapped in the wilderness. Like, there's no way out for them. He's got them right where he wants them. He's barreling down at them. They're stuck. No weapons, no training, no nothing. This is like the lamb to the slaughter. Maybe he's going to kill them all. Maybe he's going to round them up and drag them back in chains to Egypt. They're going to spend another 400 years in slavery, whatever it might be. Bad situation. He now orders his army, Pharaoh orders his army to close off the valley, and they're now trapped down by the water. Now, the men of Israel are seeing what's happened, and they begin, surprise, surprise, to lose a little confidence in Moses' leadership. Like, really, dude? Like, we went through all that, and now this? Like, of all the places to lead us, I mean, you have led us to our death. There is nowhere to turn, and so they begin to turn against Moses. Verse 11 is a really powerful verse, chapter 14, verse 11. It says this. It says, and they said to Moses, this is in the Bible, okay? Why did you bring us out here to die in the wilderness? Weren't there enough graves for us in Egypt? You hear, you can just kind of hear the tone there, you know. What have you done to us? Why did you make us leave Egypt? Because you were slaves. You're free. This is the first time in 400 years that you are free. But their complaint is, why'd you bring us out here to die in the wilderness? Weren't there enough graves in Egypt? Why did you bring us out here? What, because there weren't enough graves in Egypt to bury us? Or you bring us out here to kill us? This is some serious whining. It gets worse, though. Because then in verse 12, they continue and say, didn't we tell you that this would happen while we were in Egypt? Oh, sure you did. We said, leave us alone. Let us be slaves to the Egyptians. It's better to be a slave in Egypt than a corpse in the wilderness. I mean, the sarcasm is just dripping from this one. They so quickly forget, right, how horrible it was in Egypt. I mean, they were beaten and killed in their beatings, tortured all day long as they had to build these bricks and do everything that they were asked to do or forced to do. Generation after generation, their children were born into slavery. Their children's children were born into slavery. They knew nothing but slavery. They knew nothing but harsh conditions. They knew nothing but slavery. God rescues them through these amazing 10 plagues, brings them out of Egypt, brings them now heading towards the promised land. They find themselves in this tough situation, but instead of dealing with the tough situation, all they can do is lament of how awesome it was as a slave. Well, you brought us here because there's not enough graves in Egypt, you know? We told you when we were there, don't take us out of Egypt. Don't take us away from slavery. You read your Bible. It's nowhere in there. They never said that. I love their little phrase, though. It's better to, I bet they had a song to it. It's better to be a slave in Egypt than a corpse in the wilderness. Good golly, who was their spokesperson that wrote that one down? But this is what they did. Their complaint to Moses in this time of true peril. In fact, if you look at the beginning of Exodus 14, you'll discover that it isn't Moses that brought them to this place, to this valley, into the edge of this water, but it was God who was bringing the people out. It is God that brought them to that place. It's God who led them to the trap that they perceive to be a trap. But the reason why this verse speaks so much to me is really the next question that is probably one of the bigger questions I think all of us have in our faith journey and just as a human being in this world. Why do I have to suffer? Why do I have to go through hard times? Why do I have to have death and pain and hurt? Why do I have to have disappointment? Why do I have to have broken relationships? Why do you have to lose your job? Why do you have to have financial turmoil? Why? And sometimes we can be just like these people, right? We complain about the good old days instead of dealing with our situation. But I find myself asking those questions, why is there suffering? Why do I suffer? I'd like to say I'm above it all and like to think of global suffering in the world. I mean, just come down to it, it's just about all about me. Why do I suffer? Why do I go through hard times? Why are things difficult for me? I think we all ask these questions. The Israelites are asking this question too, because they are literally looking at their own death in front of them. There's nowhere to go. The water in front, the army behind, and a wall on either side, and it is just time before they're annihilated. Why would God lead them into such an obvious trap? Do you have an answer? Why would God lead Israel to this terrible situation? What's the reason? What's that? You got it. Bruce, you want to finish this thing? He's like, yeah, I got it. That's spot on. See, we live life, especially as Americans, we're great at this. We live life so that we don't ever need God. I mean, like, as long as I have insurance, good medical health insurance, I don't need God. I got insurance. I don't need to rely on God for anything. As long as I have a beefy retirement account, I don't need to rely on God for anything because I've got a bank account that I can rely on. As long as I have this, as long as I have that, we try to self-insure every area of our life. And if we can self-insure, there's no need for God. It's kind of like if God came to us and said, I want to lead you to the land of milk and honey. Kind of already in it. Don't need to go somewhere else. I have created my own heaven, right here. I mean, come feel the rumble of the seats in my basement as we watch this show. I've got everything I need. I open my refrigerator. I mean, I look at food that people would die to have in other places, and I thumb my nose at it. Nah, do I want meatballs? Nah. Do I want this? Nah. Ooh, that looks good. We have everything we want. We don't need God. The times that you will remember and that your faith will grow are the times when you do need to depend on God, when you can't self-insure, when you can't get it all figured out, when your best efforts do nothing, when that bank account that you have built your entire life all of a sudden disappears one day because of the economy or whatever it might be. It's at that moment you are in desperate need of God. And when God rescues you there, that's when you will remember God's faithfulness. And sometimes I think we do ourselves harm when we self-insure so much that we never need to see God ever work. And God brought the Israelites to that place at the edge of the water with walls on either side and an army of devastating ability behind them to show them something, to teach them something about him. In fact, if you're doing your fill-ins here, he wanted to teach them valuable lessons. Because if God is for us, who can what? Who can be against us? The Lord can always make a way, even when there is no way. He can make a way. And whenever things get dark, whenever things get bleak, whenever things seem hopeless, they needed to remember, and we need to remember, that God can bring them through the impossible, can bring us through the impossible. And so Moses gives some advice now to the Israelites. Again, still facing the water. The army is still coming. Maybe you even see the dust rising behind them. There's still a wall on either side. It is as hopeless as it has ever been. But God brought them there, not Moses. They're complaining to Moses, but God brought them there because he wants to teach them something. So Moses gives them some advice, as a good leader should. And he starts with some words that were probably so comforting for them to hear. He says, don't be afraid. And we got to hear this, right? In our life, don't be afraid. Yeah, but what about don't be afraid? Don't be afraid. I have a lot of things to be fearful of in my life. Don't be afraid. Yeah, but my kid's in the hospital. Don't be afraid. Yeah, but the economy. Don't be afraid. Yeah, but my marriage. Don't be afraid. Do not fear. Do not be afraid. So the people are like, yes, okay. Moses is our leader. Don't be afraid. He says don't be afraid means he's got a plan. Because otherwise you wouldn't say that. He's got a plan. What's your plan, Moses? Just stand still. Okay, Moses has completely gone nuts here. And the people are thinking, why did we ever follow this guy? Like, he's been in the communion wine. I don't know what is up with Moses. There's no way. Don't be afraid. And the reason is just stand still. Just be maybe just an easier slaughter for Pharaoh. Less pain. Just get it over with quick. You know, just cover your eyes and just let him take you out. That's your plan, Moses? Stand still. Brilliant. But he says, stand still. And watch the Lord rescue you today. You see, when you can't do it, when your self-insuring doesn't work, when you have tried and you failed, when there's no hope left, when there's no play left, when you're out of cards, when the account is on empty, when the tank is on empty, stand still. Because the Lord will rescue you today. Do you believe it? You see, if you know me at all, when it comes to personalities, some people would mistake me for a type A personality. I'm not a type A personality. But when you look at personality traits, responsibility rates really high for me, meaning I take care of my business and I don't let my business dump on you. I clean up my mess. I handle my stuff. Even if it causes stress in my life, I handle my end of it because I don't want you to have to deal with my undone stuff. That means that in my walk with God, I have a tendency to not need him as much because I got it handled. I don't like to create space where God has to work. I like to create situations where God doesn't have to work because I handle my stuff. Obviously, that's not good, but that's how I live my life. And so I always struggle with this. But there are times that if my best effort, working myself to the bone, stressing out about it, I can't seem to get ahead or I can't solve the problem. And it's in those moments I have to remember that no matter how difficult it is, when the walls are on either side and there's an impossibility in front and impossibility behind me and I can't go anywhere, but not making a decision is still going to be my ultimate destruction in the end, that I do have to be still and believe that God will rescue me in that. And not only that he will rescue me, but the next thing that Moses says, he says the Lord himself will fight for you. Just stay calm. This is so against my nature. But I have to remember, I have to do this. I have to stay calm. I have to focus. When God guides, God provides every single time. And if God brought them there, God is going to provide a way. They may not see it, they may not know it, they may not even believe it, but God still will provide. I have to remember that no matter what terrible situation I'm facing, whether it's something in my marriage, whether it's something with my kids, whether it's something in my ministry, whether it's something with a relationship in my life, whether it's something that I've created or something that's being done to me, that when I find myself in that deep, dark place with walls on either side and impossibility in front and behind, I have to remember that God brought me to this place and that he will provide. That when he created the universe, he knew that I would find myself in this position. And he's either prepared me in that situation or he's prepared others in that situation. And I have to trust that God knows that he'll rescue me, that he will provide. And the way that I know that he will rescue and that he will provide is, here I am. He's done it every time for me. Certainly not the way that I would want. Generally, never the way I would choose, but he has been there. Doesn't mean things aren't difficult. Doesn't mean things aren't painful. Doesn't mean I don't have scars. But I can see God's faithfulness, his rescue, his help in my times of trouble. And then for Moses, as he is kind of going through this idea of, you know, God guides, God provides, he starts to pray. And he prays, and he's kind of crying out to God. The people are crying out to God at this point. Like, okay, so what's the game plan here? And God has this to say. Verse 15. It says, then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the people to get moving. Okay, so remember it was just be still, stand still, be calm. That is true. I've got to do that. But then there comes a time when God says, now it's time to go. Like now. Where did they go? Where did they get moving? Yes, straight ahead. Straight ahead. The waters part. This wind rushes through, dries out the ground. They cruise across. The Israelites had this really cool thing where at nighttime there was this pillar of fire that was out in front of them and they followed it. In the daytime, the pillar of fire was gone and there was this pillar of smoke and they'd follow the pillar of smoke. Well, at this moment, everything goes cattywampus because the pillar of smoke doesn't disappear and is replaced by the pillar of fire. Pillar of fire is there and starts moving across the water. You know, the people are like, for real? Like, because you always follow the pillar of fire. They start to follow, of course, it parts, this whole thing takes place. But the pillar of smoke goes behind and lands on the Egyptian army and creates this hugely dense fog of confusion for them in nighttime. And so they're following through, and you know the story. You know, eventually the army comes in, the waters crash down, and they're saved. They find themselves on the other side, and God rescues them. Do you think any of them planned that out? Think any of them, as they were sitting there pondering all the things that might happen or could happen or what they might do, anybody have that on their radar? At what point did God know he was going to do that? Always. Always. You see how ridiculous our whining probably sounds to God? I don't know what you're going to do. I do. There's no way. Yeah, there is. When will you? My time. I will rescue you. And you really suck at this, so I'm going to fight for you. You can't do it. You can't part water. I can do it. And I will do it. God provided the most unexpected way. I think we all find ourselves in tight positions with no possible avenues of escape. And we have to remember that God allowed us to get there. And since he allowed us to get there, he wants us to trust him wholly and he will rescue us. And when we don't have the strength or ability or intelligence or physicalness to do it, God will fight for us. When I look back over my own life and I look at how God intervened in pivotal moments in my spiritual development, I would never have chosen the way that he showed up. But it's in the way he showed up that moved me to where I needed to be. If I was writing it down, you know, and God said, hey, Doug, it's the early 1990s and I need to get your attention. So what's a way I could do that? I would not have picked his way, which was cut off three fingers on my right hand. I mean, I've got a lot of other options. But that's the one that he chose. And that's the one that got my attention that brought me to the Lord. A few years later, fast forward, how's God going to get my attention to bring me into ministry? To move from construction to ministry. He decided I'd go to work one day and get fired. I came home and told my wife, I'm no longer employed. We had new car, new house. Brad was that big. I said, holy moly. And it was that moment that the church called and we started an internship at that church and they let me be a janitor there to fill up the rest of my time. Someone in the church rented us this dump, but for so cheap. Jenny's dad, who wasn't even a believer, gave me his old Datsun that only had a driver's seat in it. That's it. I kid you not. It just the driver's seat. There's lots of room for groceries, but and that's what we did. and we got into ministry. It was these moments in my life. I wouldn't have chose how they happened, but they're what had to happen for me to hear, where God says, just be still. Yeah, you can't fix it. You're out of a job. You can't fix it, but I've got this one. Yeah, you lost three fingers on your hand, but I'm going to put them back together. You're just never going to have a nail on that middle finger, but your kids are going to love it as a pacifier. They hate that story, by the way. And finally, I moved all the way to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And I started seminary. And it was on faith and fumes. And the goal was somehow get through the winters in seminary and get back to California. And a year before I'm ready to head on back to the West Coast and enjoy the sunshine and Mickey Mouse, both our pastor and associate pastor leave within a month of one another. And they were both so instrumental in my faith and my development. And I lost Harry Kelm, our senior pastor. I lost Steve Miller, our associate pastor. And it was just a youth pastor, just me, this stupid youth pastor. And if Harry wouldn't have left, and if Steve wouldn't have left, I guarantee you I would never have become the pastor here at Hillcrest. I wouldn't have chosen the way God did the things that he did. But it's by doing things the way that he did those things brought me to the place where I needed to be, because he was going to rescue me in every one of those, and he fought the battles for me. I just had to show up. And I try so hard sometimes, and I just fear I'm going to get to heaven, and God's going to sit down with me and say, you know how many times you just flat out got in the way? Not only in your life, but in other people's lives. Like, could you just chill? Because I got this. But see, I'm looking at the water. I'm like, okay, we can swim. Let's swim. And I need people around me to go, we're going to die. That's dumb. Okay, then let's turn around and let's battle the Egyptians. Let's find rocks. I have great faith. No, you're dumb. You can't beat an Egyptian army with rocks. There's only one way that we can win this battle, and that's through the Lord. Whatever he chooses. And the moment comes in all of our lives, in our times of trouble, our despair, with walls on either side, with an impossibility of front, impossibility behind, and we get on our knees and we cry out before God, and then God says, why are you crying out? Get up. It's go time. It is go time. You cross that raw water, or if I told you to go the other way and to go against that army, you go against it. If I tell you to dig a hole right through that mountain, you're going to do that. But I will do it for you. I will be before you. It's been an example in my life and the life of others. As much as we try, as much as we struggle, as much as we wish that we could do it, it's God and what he's up to that makes a difference. What's your trouble today? What's your difficulty? What's your impossibility? Where is it that there are walls on both sides, an impossibility in front of you and an impossibility behind you? Because even though you can't see it right now, is it possible, just possible, that God might be using that event to shape his plan in your life, to bring you to the place where you need to be? You might have caused your trouble. I'm sorry about that. But God can use all things for good for those who are faithful. Trust in him. So yeah, you can create your own mess. God can still use your own messes. The mess could have been done to you. You might be an innocent victim of it all. It's not a mystery to God. He knows. And he can still use that to shape his will, his plan, his goals in you. That you'll be more like him today than you were yesterday, more like him tomorrow than you are today. So if you're at those crossroads and you don't know what to do, I encourage you to pray, and maybe, just maybe, God will do for you what you cannot do for yourself. This past year, Pastor Brian and I have been running the 180 student ministry, and it has made us both young and old at the same time. We have thoroughly enjoyed it, and we were thoroughly worn out. But we love those kids, we love this church, and we would give as much of ourselves as we possibly could for that. And we were looking for someone and couldn't find someone. We searched and searched and searched. We could find no one. We had people that applied, we interviewed people, but everybody, no way, you're not getting our kids. We had high standards, but it was getting tiresome for us. And about 7 weeks ago now, I remember sitting down with Pastor Brian and I said, dude, we have gone, I call him dude, we've been everywhere. We have got this application everywhere. We've been to pastors, we've been to churches, we've been at message boards. We go to all of these things where we can get the information out there, and we have not found anybody. He said, maybe we're not hearing God. Maybe there's something God is trying to tell us here, because it felt like impossibility on all sides and walls around us, and there's no hope for us. And I felt convicted that I needed to fast and pray. And so I chose to do that, all I could do. And I fasted and I prayed day after day after day. Little did I know that there was this guy named Eric, that while I'm fasting and praying, God tells him to quit his job as a teacher because he's got something for him in ministry. And he started to explore what that was. Somehow, he heard about Hillcrest. He applied, we interviewed, and it wasn't long before we just knew this is where God was leading us. Did we fill the position because I fasted and prayed? No. But fasting and praying got me to quit doing all the things that were happening that was getting in the way of what God wanted to have done. I had to be still. I had to be quiet. I had to be calm. And I had to remember that God will rescue us. And not only God will rescue, but he will fight the battle for us. So if I look at this verse, which has just become a life verse for me, and I translate this verse into a different translation, it would look like this. This is Exodus 14, 13 and 14 in the B-A-D translation. Yes, it's a bad translation, but it's the Bible according to Doug. And it says this, don't be afraid, just stand still and watch the Lord fill the position. The vacancy you see today will be filled by me. I will fill the position for you. I already selected a guy named Eric. I told him already to quit his job. So just stay calm. What might God be wanting to do for you if you pause and watch his powerful story and plan unfold before your own eyes? God wanted to teach me a valuable lesson. And I believe he wants to teach you one too. Because when God guides, God provides. Let's sing.